Sunstone presents Bishop's Roundtable, Managers, Ministers, or Mentors. Recorded live at the 1986 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 20th through the 23rd. We take you to the Salt Lake Sheraton Towers, where the program is just now beginning.
The session that is entitled the Bishop's Roundtable. This session is sponsored by Dialogue. Co-editor Linda Newell is here, and we urge you to make sure and stop at the Dialogue table if you haven't already. Permit me to introduce the panel members. On your left, Thane Robson of the University of Utah, with a professor in management there and is with the Bureau of Economics and Business Development. Lowell Bennion, presently with the Community Services Council, formerly with the university and with the Institute of Religion. And on your right, Doug Alder, who asked me to indicate to you that he's with Utah State, director of the Honors Program. I'm the moderator, Dick Fox, of the law firm of Fox, Edwards, Gardner, and Brown. I should mention that each of us has served as a bishop. I think Thane Robson holds a record. He's served three separate times. Each would serve again if asked. I understand Lowell would insist on a guaranteed 25-year tenure.
I would guarantee it.
Yeah, Thane's in a position to make that guarantee. Our purpose is to provide insight into the role of a bishop with the objective of fostering realistic expectations and improving relationships between members and bishops. In defining the purpose that way, we've eliminated some other fascinating possibilities. This isn't to be a bishop's training session, nor will there be disclosures of some of the secrets that we've always wanted to talk about, but unfortunately, we're all too close to home. There will be a presentation by each of the panelists of approximately 7 to 10 minutes, followed by comments by members of the panel, and then we'll open the session to questions and comments from the floor. We'll ask Lowell Bennion to start, and he has selected the topic, how the bishop serves human needs. He'll be followed by, Doug, you go next, who will talk about listening and counseling as a bishop. And then Thane will tell us how bishops are called and how they operate. And if there's time left, I'll talk about worthiness interviews. So we'll start with really the feature attraction, Lowell Bennion.
I didn't expect to see anybody here today, and I wonder why you're here. How many of you aspire to be bishops? you women think you're going to get the priesthood and become bishops? Well, I think the main problem that a bishop has is to decide whether he's going to run an organization or meet the needs of his people. Be a pastor of the flock. I decided when I was called to be a bishop that I would think in terms of people, not organization and not meetings and activities. To me, there are three things important in religion. The most important thing are persons. Most important thing in heaven or earth, I believe, are human beings, deity, but persons. Second most important thing in religion are gospel principles, maybe gifts along with principles. I'm thinking of faith and humility and love and integrity and fundamentals of this kind. The third principle, the third important thing in religion to me is the church. I put it third because the church is a means to an end. It's not an end in itself. It's a means of getting, I think, gospel principles into the lives of human beings. And I think we need to keep that perspective if we're in the role of a bishop or not a bishop. I think it's a fundamental idea. For example, we're not here to serve the church as a bishop. We're here to serve people through the church. I keep telling my teachers, I used to tell them when I had opportunity, that they're not teaching lessons, not even teaching the gospel, they're teaching people, class members. And the gospel is a means to an end, as well as the church. Along with this idea of affecting people as a bishop, may I suggest that there's a special need, I think, in the LDS Church to cultivate spirituality. We're so loaded with activities and meetings and lessons and talk and so on that I think sometimes we don't think in terms of real spiritual development of our people. We tried a few things. When I was a lad growing up, we had a marvelous bishop. He's been my ideal of a bishop ever since. His name was Elias S. Woodruff. He never had a course in psychology or sociology or philosophy. He was a businessman. I doubt he went to college. But he was a marvelous bishop. And to illustrate his spirituality, when I was a priest and he was the bishop, he would say sometimes before the sacrament meeting, after the sacrament song, if you will, he would say, "Brothers and sisters, it now becomes our sacred privilege to unite our hearts with the brethren of the priest quorum in offering the blessing on the bread and the water." Boy, did I feel a thrill and a spiritual need and feeling when I knelt down at the sacrament table with all hearts united with mine, and I was spokesman for the congregation, if you will. I tried hard as a bishop to get our priests to feel and think and express themselves at the sacrament table with feelings and thoughts, not just recitation, if you will. Another illustration, trying to cultivate some spirituality and thinking in terms of people. We tried to think in terms of who's in our ward. Are they old people? Are they young people? What do they need? And instead of just asking brethren or sisters to speak, we try to suggest a purpose in their sacrament meeting talks. For example, how do you strengthen young people to live ideals? Or how do you encourage them to and give them some ways of resisting temptation? Talk with a purpose. Focus on some of the congregation, if you will. Give old people some hope for eternal life and immortality and the joys of old age, such as they are. But let me give another illustration. We have fast and testimony meeting every month. We have a fast day. It occurred to me that instead of just saying next Sunday is fast day, why not say fast for a purpose next Sunday? Think of somebody in the ward who needs your faith and prayers. Or maybe you might ask the whole congregation to exercise faith on behalf of a group or on behalf of an individual in the community. But the main thing is to think and feel and express yourself with the spiritual goals and purposes. I think that's all I have to say at this point. Let me repeat that the important thing, the most important thing on earth are people. And the bishop's in a remarkably favorable situation to relate to people, to individuals, in their interest, trying to meet their needs. Let me give one other illustration. I won't, I hope, impose on Doug Alder's comment, but the bishop does a lot of counseling, and I learned it before I was a bishop. I learned it as an institute teacher, but I learned not to try to solve problems, not to focus on problems, but to focus on the individual, to try to strengthen the individual to solve his or her own problems, to face up to the realities of life. And I found that very meaningful. I enjoyed my term as bishop, largely because of the human ties and relationships that it offered me. Thank you.
It's moving to me to follow Lowell Bunyan. He's been my mentor for 35 years and is the greatest influence in my life besides my father. He was my model when I became a bishop because I had imposed upon him in two or three moments in my life to counsel me. One of the things that's exciting, I think, about bishops is that people are not resistant to going to bishops for counsel like they are to going to professional counselors. There doesn't have to be something wrong with you to go see a bishop because, as we'll hear, we go through interviews regularly and they are a confidant and a highly respected person in our life, and therefore it is appropriate that we can turn to them. That's a tremendous resource. One of the young men who was in my ward later became a psychologist, and for his dissertation, he studied lay counselors. And I was one of his objects and read some of the material he had in his dissertation, and I was surprised to find that some data shows that lay counselors do just as well as professional counselors. That doesn't mean that either of them do too well, but there is some interesting data on that, and I suspect it's very similar with school teachers. The research on school teachers shows that about 50% of the secret of success of a school teacher is simply having a healthy personality, something that cannot be taught in a college of education. And supposedly bishops are called because they're spiritually and physically healthy personalities, and that in some ways qualifies them to be counselors. I took a course as a young man in preparation to be a school teacher on counseling and came across Rogerian ideas of non-directive counseling. Later, I had an opportunity through some Catholic friends to read some of the literature about directive counseling. And it seems to me that bishops can glean two important ideas from those two schools of thought. The Rogerian technique teaches us to listen and be non-judgmental. And I think that's the first lesson every bishop needs to learn. And it's very nicely stolen from Carl Rogers and put in the little book that is given to bishops on counseling. Fortunately, I'm very glad it's there. So, of course, you don't say, "You what?" It isn't hard for bishops to learn that because the people who come and counsel with a bishop teach a bishop a great deal. And at least I, and I'm sure every bishop, said, "My golly, these problems are ones I either had, have, or could have had." And so it isn't very difficult to be supportive and listening. The directive counseling literature suggests that it comes mostly out of Catholic thought, and I think we fit there, that it's not a service to a person who comes for counsel to offer them nothing. And my experience in the church as a counselor and a bishop is, and this is a secret that I think is very important, that when a person comes to a bishop for counsel, they pretty well bring the answer with them and want firm support to make the decision they need to make. And therefore, we move to Brother Bunyan's second point about principles. I think it's a bishop's role to help a person come to cherish the principles and set a path to implement the principles in their life. But the job isn't to tell them what to do. The people already know what to do. They just need the love and the support to apply those principles. One of the problems I found as a bishop is the question of availability. I'd suggest there's two sides to the problem of availability, physical and spiritual. It's sometimes difficult to be available, to be in the office when a person needs you. My two callings as bishop were both in singles wards, one on a college campus and one in a community with working people. I averaged over 30 hours a week in counseling. It's a little different in a normal ward. Brother Benyon averaged at least that many hours, it seemed to me, when I was at the Institute. People were in seeing him day and night. And I can remember, when I think back, you know, I went to his home twice. One time he was on the ladder painting, and he was very subtle. I didn't get the message until many years later. He kept painting. I talked to him. He didn't even get off the ladder. I talked to him for an hour. And, you know, it was an ultimate issue. He'd probably had seven of them that day. But he was available. Now, he wasn't just available, you know, he wasn't in his office. So the point is, are you available any time? But the other point is, a bishop needs to be available spiritually. And I find that many bishops simply don't like to counsel. Partly because we as bishops sometime have not come to terms with ourselves. When we hear people talk to us about problems, there's things we ought to have talked about or would like to talk about or feel very uncomfortable talking about. And so that's one thing that I think a bishop really needs to get going on, is if he doesn't like to counsel, he better find out why. Because I think a bishop's job is to be the judge in Israel, and in my estimation, counseling is where it's at. I have a brother-in-law who's a psychiatrist, and he gave me his 7 years of training in psychiatry in this way. He said, during the first visit, you listen, and you listen, and you listen, and you say, aha. And in the second visit, you listen, and you listen, and you say, hmm. And in the third visit, you listen, and you listen, and then you say, I think you've come to the point that I'm going to let you handle that one on your own. So you listen. You listen. Some other things about listening. I think it's terribly important. The whole principle of repentance is that it must be the person's own victory. A person needs to bring the problem to the bishop. We'll get to worthiness interviews in a minute, but I'm not comfortable probing, but I'm also not comfortable waiting. And so I kind of think that we should move in between, make it easy for people to come. Generally, well, not always, but sometimes I knew long before the person came that he needed to come, he or she. And so I found little ways of tripping them, you know, just kidding them and saying, hey, when are we going for a walk? Or there needs to be little ways to send signals that say, I'm ready when you're ready. But to steal the person's sacred privilege to make the decision that they want to talk about it, I think isn't quite fair. Now then, the second thing I think that in this listening that it's very important is that I think the bishop needs to help prepare the person to take some steps, particularly when it's necessary for a court. I just personally feel, having gone through several, that it's just a crying shame to let a person go into a court if they're not ready and if they don't want to do it. And it's the bishop's job to help that person move in the direction in that way. Well, I think I've said enough. If you're just desperately anxious to hear any more, I have some very bad reprints of two articles that I printed, published, one in Dialogue and one in Sunstone. This one is about how bishops prepare people for excommunication courts, and the other one is just how a bishop autobiographical found out what the job is to be a judge in Israel.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be here this afternoon, and I want to defend a simple proposition that former bishops are the strength and backbone of Mormon society, and I offer in evidence my pal Lowell Bunyan, my friend Doug Alder, and Dick Fox. There are other heroes of mine in this audience. Leonard Arrington, who's always been a hero since the day he allowed me to sit in his office at Utah State. And I was going to get to your bishop and my brother. And I would even acknowledge my daughter, though is it all right to have a daughter as a hero, Lowell? I've never cleared that with you. It's all right. When I got a letter from Jack and Linda about the panel, the first question they said that this panel might address was a question, why do you think you were called? And I want you to know there are people in three wards that have asked that question 1,000 times. And they've never gotten a satisfactory answer. And I'm not sure that I can give you a satisfactory answer. But I've thought about it since I got that letter. Why were you called? Or more particularly, how do bishops get called in the church? And I've thought back over the three times I had that experience, and would give you sort of a composite about what I was told at the time, because I think it's relatively significant, though on one of those occasions a stake president came to my house, and he sat on my couch in the front room, and he said, do you know why I'm here? And I said, yes, I know why you're here, and I told him why he had come, and then because I told him that, he just about didn't make the call. It doesn't always pay to be honest and forthright. But in any case, the composite goes like this. The bishops are told, or at least I was told when I was called, that I'd been called by the Lord through the inspiration given to the stake presidency that had, in fact, been cleared with the High Council and approved by the first presidency of the church. And that's what I was told, that the Lord wanted me to serve as bishop of this ward at that particular point in time. And then you start with the notion, is that a plausible explanation as to why people, our bishops, are called? And I guess I would say to you today, as I said to my wife and family and others at that time, yes, that's plausible. That answer was plausible to me when I was called first 24 years ago, and it's still plausible after two subsequent calls. Out of the last 24 years, I've spent 10 of those serving as a bishop. In two cases, my own spiritual promptings alerted me to the impending call. In the third case, the confirmation came after and not before the call. In every case, I believe that I had been called by revelation, and that in spite of my weaknesses and imperfections, I did in fact receive a personal spiritual confirmation regarding the appropriateness of the service I had been called to perform. While I have had other callings in the church, none have come with the strength of spiritual confirmation as strong as that which came with the call to serve as a bishop. Which causes me to interject at this point. I started, made these notes and thought, now why did they not ask three or four non-bishops to discuss this issue? Because I've never met a bishop who was so humble as to admit that he hadn't been called by the Lord or by inspiration, or who really thought anybody had made a mistake in calling him. It's been my, and I don't mean that in any sacrilegious sense. One of the things that fascinates me, in addition to serving three times as a bishop, I've served on four high councils and witnessed changes in ward leadership repeatedly, and on occasion, a couple of times when I didn't get quick spiritual confirmation about the appropriateness of the call, it came later, but in every case, the rightness of the call was made spiritually known to me, and I suppose that the faithful in the church have no trouble with that concept, and others might have a lot of trouble with that particular concept. Now, I think we go beyond that because that inspiration and revelation simply doesn't occur in a vacuum. I think there are a variety of things that enter into the minds of state presidencies and those who are charged with finding bishops. I think they look at what they perceive to be the needs of the ward in terms of the demographic makeup and characteristics of the ward. I think they consider carefully the availability, and every time I was called, somewhere along the call, is there any good reason why you shouldn't serve? Are you getting along all right with your wife and your children? And I always hurry to answer that question rather than leave it with my wife to answer, and things of that sort. But by and large, having met those kind of minimal requirements about availability of time, looking at the needs of the ward, but it was never made clear to me, and it's never been explained, though I've listened to lots of discussions, precisely how you translate the needs of the ward or the time and availability. Sure, that sometimes the calls have been extraordinarily inconvenient and inappropriate, or at least I thought I would rather schedule them at a different time. But in each time, I think in my own case, as in the case of others I've witnessed, did not one welcome the call, embrace the call, thought that it would bring great blessings into their lives and into the lives of their family, and furthermore were frightened to death and wouldn't have dared reject the call under any circumstances. Now, I probably got that from Leonard Arrington. I don't know where I would have developed fears like that, except at your side. Certainly, Lowell never taught me to fear. He taught me to love. Did you teach me to fear? You're not going to plead guilty. I've watched people with a wide range of skills and abilities and interests perform extraordinarily well in the office of bishop, and I've come to ask myself the question, how can this be? I remember, I hope we're far enough away from home, I was living in Los Angeles ward at a time when we had a lot of marvelous, great, successful, and learned men in that ward, and they made a change in the bishop, and they called a plant guard to be the bishop, and I thought, my, what a terrible mistake that is. He turned out to be one of the greatest bishops simply because he had the capacity to love and he had the compassion and he had a commitment to service that was second to the service I've witnessed any other man. I've repented of that, Lowell, many times. I've really asked for forgiveness that I thought poorly of that bishop at the time he was called, and I got to repent publicly at his funeral. But the point I want to make is that I've watched large numbers of people perform in that office and be extraordinarily successful. And I've thought a little bit about that from the perspective of organizational theory, from the perspective of management thought. And when you get down to it, the office of a bishop is an interesting office in the Mormon Church. He is at once the father of the ward, the presiding high priest. He does, in fact, have the control and power and authority to call and release people in various callings within the church. On the other hand, he is instructed to take two counselors and an executive secretary and must report to and be accountable to a state presidency. He's given a priesthood quorum structure and an auxiliary organization structure, a handbook, and essentially an organizational setting within which to work that really doesn't allow him to do other much more than express the Christian ideal, which is a part of that office and inherent in the office, and a part of both symbolically and in very practical terms in the expectation and lives of the members who really constitute a support system for that bishop. And I'm inclined to think, in my own experience, that the office molds the man much more than the man molds the office. We always worry about that in studying organizations. If Lowell takes over an organization, it's clear that he molds the organization to his great personality and Christian character. The same thing would be true of Doug Alder everywhere, but where he's headed now, and they'll get you down there, Douglas. But here is a case where I think the office molds the man and not the other way around. I'm not going to prolong that discussion, but I really think that's appropriate. If you look at the organization, you look at the management structure that a bishop is given in terms of agendas and minutes and planning schedules, following up and reporting systems, and he's given tools and programs and activities, and all he has to do, in my judgment, is to be prepared to follow willingly and honestly and openly the instructions that he's given at the time he's called. Now, that starts to break down at the point where both Lowell and Doug put that bishop in his office in counseling one-on-one with the members of the ward, especially those who are in trouble, those who are come to repent of serious transgressions. And that puts where he finds himself, reaching deep down into his own soul and his own Christian conscience to try to both administer the doctrine of the church and at the same time bring his own love and compassion to bear to help and assist the person who's in trouble. Most of the counseling, I would suggest, Doug, is of not that order. Most of the time I spent in counseling, fortunately, weren't really those soul-gripping experiences when you said, gee, I would rather be somewhere else. Most of it was extraordinarily pleasant. Well, I think maybe my 7 minutes are gone and I ought to stop. Bishops, it's a very fundamental question. To what extent are bishops really in control when they are called and preside in that office? And to what extent are they picked up literally in an organizational and in a doctrinal and in a spiritual and in symbolic sense and carried by virtue of the office which they hold, the mantle of the bishop? And their success is almost guaranteed by the nature of the call and what they're told and their commitment not to detract in any way from an institutional and a theological requirement that is imposed on the office of a bishop. I wish I were bright enough and wise enough to answer that question the way I'd like to, but the more I have thought about it, in my own experience and others, is that it is extraordinarily difficult for a bishop in the Mormon church to fail. The church, the office, the institution, the doctrine, the theology, the management tools and procedures virtually guarantee a high degree of success. I don't mean that to take or detract in any way from the office and calling. Indeed, I'm fascinated at how any organization could, much the same thing I think can be said of stake presidents and be said of Relief Society presidents, of quorum presidents, and I'm fascinated, and Lowell will explain to me someday, why it is that the organization has the capability of taking common, ordinary, garden variety farm boys and giving them the exhilarating, rewarding, loving, expanding experience of serving in these high and sacred callings. And I was much touched by Dick Fox's, though I want to go home and think about it, I don't think I told you I was willing to serve again. But if I were put on the... There's no stake presidents here, are there? And I don't have to answer the question. Thank you.
In order for someone to witness the marriage of a loved one, a bishop's signature is required on a temple recommend. And at times, it's rather crucial whether one is deemed to be a full or part tithe payer. There are many interviews with youth. There are interviews that may result in church callings. And I would like to categorize these types of interviews very generally as worthiness interviews. I learned early on that I couldn't expect the kind of inspiration that would result in discernment that I suppose every judge would love to have, that someone is guilty or innocent, that there may be transgressions, or that some who feel they have transgressed really have not and need to be persuaded otherwise. And I would say that I can think of numberless instances where, as a bishop, I've had a responsibility to urge people not to judge themselves so harshly, to accept what they have done, to work through burdens of guilt and proceed on with their lives. And I can only think of two instances where I feel there has been direct misrepresentation, and as a bishop I was unable to persuade these two individuals to confess and turn their lives about. And the reason I'm quite sure about those two instances is that I passed on them rather eagerly, and then they came back and discussed with me the fact that they were convinced they had misrepresented. I suppose that other bishops and others in positions of responsibility to make those kinds of judgment have about the same kind of batting average, because I think we're aware of situations like that, even where the First Presidency over a long period of time has been unaware that great leaders have been involved in transgression. And so I'm not sure that any of us should expect this neon sign type revelation of guilt or innocence. And instead, it seems to me that that the bishop's role is to hold up a set of standards, and that in a very real sense, the person answering the question becomes the judge. This is a reality because the words of the questions of these interviews, questions involving certain moral characteristics, certain practices, and a degree of commitment, these questions and words mean something quite different to each of us. There is an enormous amount of subjectivity that is brought to an interpretation of the words. And if we did understand precisely the same thing about the meaning of these questions in this type of interview, we then have the problem of judging actions against those defined standards. And again, this involves considerable subjectivity. For me, the questions that we asked, and it was generally very fulfilling. It was a very rewarding assignment. This aspect of the assignment, to talk to people and give them a chance to respond to those questions, which usually inspired me because of their commitment. It was generally a very positive thing for me. But the act of measuring their actions against those standards would not be uniform at all. And so I think there is an enormous amount of personal responsibility as worthiness interviews are conducted. And that is reassuring to me. It's reassuring because I am convinced, and I have seen dramatic results where people work through problems in a way that they are not burdened with guilt. Unresolved guilt is in my view, one of the most deadly, defeating conditions that one can suffer. It's enormously burdensome, and part of the process of working through that can involve a bishop, but it requires someone other than the person carrying the burden. And to see the results of people who would work effectively through that kind of a problem and see what can happen when the burden is lifted was very rewarding. The basic premise that grows out of my experience has been then that we generally tend to judge ourselves, and I don't mean to say by that that a bishop is not a judge. When transgressions become evident, there are responsibilities and steps that must be taken. But I see generally the bishop not so much as the prosecutor as one who can be very supportive and reassuring and can be a vehicle toward a much less burdensome condition for those with the motivation and direction to work through the problem. Now, we will take some moments now for panel members to comment and question. I'm not sure that these microphones. Well, let's try using these microphones at this stage, and if they don't work, we'll use the pulpit. And following a period then, as we comment about what one another said, we'll open it for questions. Lowell, do you want to start with?
Go ahead. Speak again for an hour.
I want to tell you what troubled me as a bishop. One of my heartaches. I didn't like being a judge, a common judge in Israel. I've never felt comfortable judging my fellow human beings. And I tried to get people to... First of all, I tried to establish a relationship with my parishioners, one in which they knew I respected them and loved them and was not going to condemn them or judge them. And then I tried to get them to see principles involved that they were out of harmony with, tried to get them to recognize and admit their basis for their behavior. I avoided any excommunications and disfellowshipping while I was bishop. I don't believe in excommunication except under three conditions. One is if somebody demands it. No point in keeping them in the church if they don't want to be there. Secondly, if somebody were really tearing the church apart with action, with talk, were real, trying to undermine the faith of people, that might be a basis for excommunication. I think a third, if a person would not repent, was a real bounder. And you worked with him and couldn't change his point of view at all, that might be justification. But I had several people who committed grave sins but were really penitent. And I kept their confidentiality and did not call for a court. That's the way I feel about judging and excommunication. I just think it's kind of out of harmony with the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Open it up for questions then, and to make sure this gets on the tape, I may repeat the question. if you don't direct the question to a member of the panel, then we can just ask for someone to volunteer. Yes. Attempt to repeat the question, Brother Bennion.
I can just reiterate pretty much what I said. Well, one thing I liked about being bishop, I felt it was one office and calling that one still had some autonomy in, some freedom, and. And I think our stake president respected our autonomy to quite an extent. So I felt comfortable. And I was too busy to read the bishop's handbook, so I didn't have to follow it.
I was called to be a bishop of a ward that was brand new the day it began. And I'll tell you, I was awfully glad for all those handbooks, especially the financial and physical and all those kinds of things. I wouldn't have had a clue how to do it. And I had a terrific staff of people, and I just gave them assignments, and man, we had that thing in shape in a matter of a month. Everything was going. So I think there's some value to the structure. But I really strongly support Lowell's point. It's amazing how much discretion a bishop has. I've seen bishop, you know, the least they can do, the most they can do is release you. And I've only seen that happen once, that a bishop was released because he wouldn't follow the program. And I don't know a bishop who didn't abandon the program on some point here and there.
I'd like to make two quick comments. One is, I think you misunderstood, and obviously generalizations are difficult unless they're adequately developed. But I've not known a bishop to fail. I've never seen a failure as a bishop, and I've lived in a dozen wards. I've seen people with strengths in one area and strength in another area. And I certainly concur that the first obligation is the pastoral duties to the flock, not the organization. But I don't think that conflict is there nearly to the extent that a lot of people like to think that conflict is there. And I sent women home teaching, and I put scouts in other people's troops and took other people's scouts in my troops, and I think there is a good deal of flexibility within that organization to do whatever you want, well, within limits. But there is a good deal of all the flexibility of the examples you've cited. I've never felt constrained in any sense on those issues. I was taught by Lowell Bunyan a long time ago, it's a lot easier to get forgiveness than it is permission. And I've always followed that rule in administration in the church.
They finally got Lowell.
Lady?
If a person is not repentant, won't change his life and is committing grave sins of child abuse, for example, I think excommunication would be in order.
I think even when they are repentant, they need to be part of the process in order to convict them. Later, too many
I'm not sure that works. We had a stake president who came to our high priest meeting and talked about excommunication. And we asked him, on what basis do you decide whether or not a person should hold a court? And he said, we decide on the value that it will be to the person involved. Now, I think basically that's true, that if you're sure the best way to help a person repent or change his life is to hold a court, then the court is justified. Otherwise, I think we should be very slow to take people through a court process. I hasten to add that you have to consider other people involved too. In fact, you make your decisions in life in terms of how your decision affects people more than on any other basis. All people involved, I believe.
Question, back row.
Before and during the course of
certainly put me on the spot. I was on the correlation committee, the youth correlation committee, the first 10 years of its existence. I've never worked so hard and accomplished so little in the church in my life. I finally asked to be released. I think correlation is can rob the church of creativity and freedom and flexibility. I think committees can't write anything. I think they're good for motivation and criticism, but not for real production. So I have mixed feelings about correlation, frankly. I think it has its good and bad aspects. I need help from my colleagues.
I'd like to make just a comment on that, because I was involved in the correlation committee too. I was not a bishop before, so I couldn't say. But it was really funny to be involved in correlation and then be a bishop. And I'd look up that pipe and I'd hardly ever see anything come out the end. And of course then during the day I'd be putting things in up at the pipe. Correlation had an awful lot to do with doctrine and manuals and things of that nature, but golly, I didn't even see any impact on our ward. We just went, of course we were in singles wards, and singles wards were different because they just went like gangbusters in 50 directions. But I don't think there was a person in either ward I was in who'd ever heard of correlation, and I didn't bother to tell them. It's a support mechanism having largely to do with doctrine. But I did not feel constrained, and I didn't see that my ward members felt very constrained.
You didn't have the force of the church organization.
No, that's true. We had no primary. But we had people. And let me tell you, I had generally 500 families. That was a fun home teaching program.
Yes, sir. The question is, how can you be a 15-hour bishop? I think I'm most qualified to answer that. I spent the least time at the job. This also is on point with an earlier question referring to 28 categories of responsibilities, most of which are non-delegable for a bishop. I think the first thing that must be recognized is the job description of for a bishop, and perhaps this is true of many other callings, sets impossible parameters. So you start out recognizing that this is a job that can't be done. It cannot be done even by someone who works at it full time. So this is where a good deal of discretion comes in, and I think this is why it's prudent to rotate bishops frequently, because a bishop must select priorities then, knowing that it all cannot be done. The frustrating thing that Lowell referred to is that there are some time-consuming responsibilities, administrative meetings and so forth, where you cannot apply priorities. That is, if a bishop doesn't attend certain meetings, that's tantamount to requesting a release. But other than that, there can be choices, and since bishops then concentrate, focus on different areas and assess different priorities, it's wise to change so that someone who will, with a different set of priorities, will come and do the things that bishop didn't do. I think that all of us, as we met, expressed the frustration that we couldn't possibly meet the expectations even of the job description, let alone what people hoped and thought we'd be doing. So, if you have 15 hours, then that just means you leave more undone than someone who might have 20 hours. Thane?
A couple of quick comments on that issue, and that is that I don't know anybody who ever learned how to do the job in 15 hours unless they had no funerals, no baptisms, and no problems in the ward. On the other hand, I've watched bishops work extraordinarily hard and not accomplish a whole lot. This issue about delegating, the key to that problem is to select counselors who will take the work away from you and don't give you a choice as to whether you delegate or not. And then every smart bishop, the first thing I learned was that you keep out of the way of the Relief Society and let them run the ward. Now, you don't let them know that that's what's happening, but that's pretty critical to the success of any ward. And I suppose the best counselor I ever had in the bishopric was my Relief Society president. And that's, you delegate informally a tremendous amount of work and activity as long as you don't let her or anybody else know what it is you're doing. I don't know whether, do we have to be honest today, Lowell? Or
I've tried to be.
You don't know any other way, but I do.
Confession is good for the soul.
I'm not sure I'd always use the word indirectly, but the rest of it I would concur with.
My question is aimed at the Catholic aspect of bishoping. Is there a point in when people are coming to you in regular interviews and start opening up to you in ways that that let you counsel them, and then when they come in for specific counseling? Are there points along the way where a bishop realizes that they are not prepared to handle some of the things that maybe marriage problems, maybe things such as infants that you were referring to and those kinds of things, and that perhaps you need to refer them elsewhere? At what point do you do that, and who do you refer them to, and then how do you continue to work with the family in those circumstances?
Thanks. That was a point I wanted to bring up. The first time I was a bishop, our stake president, who was a totally unlearned man, brought in the head of the counseling department from the university for a couple of training sessions, and that counseling person specifically addressed the question of how do you recognize when you're in deeper than you know how to deal with it. That was really helpful to me because I was young and just swimming, and I went to a couple of the other bishops and asked for some help. But Dr. Peterson very helpfully taught us, and I just wish every bishop had this opportunity, what manic depressive is and a whole bunch of other things like that. Not that we could diagnose, but it very quickly became clear to me that one of my jobs was to refer people. And the second time I was bishop, I guess I must have referred 100 people in the four-year period. And I developed a working relationship with every agency in our county, with the counselors in the schools, with the Bear River Mental Health people, with the social services people, with private practice people, and rather quickly developed some discernment as to who seemed to be more successful with some things and who seemed to be more successful with others, some people that I didn't have confidence in at all. That doesn't mean that then I just walked away from that. I think a bishop, particularly the social services attitude, is that they want to work with the bishop, not to replace. So that you're dealing with some stuff way over our heads. But I think we continue to be maintain a relationship with that person, even though we have them dealing with professionals. One other point that I didn't make is the question of dependence versus independence.
Brother Packer has been very well known for urging bishops not to counsel too much. And I just had to make a few mistakes before I found out the wisdom of that. There are people who would like your time every week for a couple of hours. And at first I was really excited about that because I felt I was being loved. But it took just a little experience and a couple of harsh bishop colleagues to tell me that I was seeking love rather by making these people dependent. So you get a bishop gets into some really deep water, and I think it's very important that we learn our limitations.
I would only add that I think some of the most important things I did as a bishop involved referrals to professionals. And sometimes that can come from a bishop in a less threatening way than from a loved one. When someone really close in the family says, you need to see a psychiatrist, sometimes that's interpreted as a judgment that the person's crazy. And I think a bishop sometimes, it depends on the situation, may be able to handle that in a way that's more apt to get the individual to the professional who can really be of assistance.
Experienced exactly like you're saying, and it was extremely important for me that the person did risk. It was someone they loved very much, were very close to. There was a worthiness problem that I was not privy to because of deception. I was extremely grateful that person came to me, and it was very hard for them to do so. The law of free agency governs in all of those places. The person who did not disclose had the free agency not to do so, and maybe it was the only way that person could cope. The person who did come in confidence had the free agency not to, took the agency to do so, showed an enormous trust in the bishop's confidentiality. We haven't talked about confidentiality, but it's just paramount. One of the things that I enjoyed in my ward was my wife and I had an agreement that we simply didn't ever talk about any of these matters, and all of the ward members assumed that my wife knew their problems. And it was delightful for her in talking with people. They would say, well, now, you understand this, and my wife said, I understand what? And it was a wonderful freedom for her to not know anything and for people to discover that she not know anything. So confidentiality was important, and particularly in that incident, the confidentiality was absolutely essential.
But given another bishop, wouldn't it be possible that they would consider the person coming to you as meddling?
Sure. I think given this bishop, too, the bishop had to weigh that matter. The world's imperfect. I'm sure every one of you in this room can tell all kinds of horror stories about things that have gone wrong in a counseling situation with a bishop. And you can say the same thing with counselors who are professionals that have gone wrong. The world isn't fair or perfect.
See, Lowell, you spoke about that. Do you want to respond, or do you?
Well, I think you should try to help a man to give the prayer properly and not embarrass him if he can't. Give him other things to do if a person can't learn to give the prayer to his own satisfaction.
We have a priest with a speech impediment who has difficulty saying the sacrament prayer, but has the courage to continue to do it, and it's really quite a spiritual experience, I think, for the rest of us. And probably your question goes the other way, that is, that the problem arises out of indifference, lack of concentration, and that sort of thing. Dyslexia.
Maybe dyslexia, inability to read.
In which event it could be enormously embarrassing then to insist, continue trying. So it would depend, I imagine, on the situation. Yes.
Brother Robinson talked about all bishops being called divinely through God. Well, this seems to filter down, then, as bishops call members in their ward, they always tell you who will be called under the direct inspiration of your Heavenly Father and who wants you to do this. Now, having had many leadership positions, I know that often, as you're casting the bishop, be called out of desperation as often as you do inspiration. Why, Brother Daniel asked you, why do bishops feel a need to try to put that kind of guilt trip on people that's from directly from their Heavenly Father, when sometimes those people are going to have to turn those callings down and then they feel like they've let the Lord down? When a lot of times those callings were just the only person they could find, you know, things to do.
I think it's Brother Robeson's responsibility to answer that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm quite willing to admit there are calls of inspiration and calls of desperation, and I'm not sure all bishops are smart enough to know which is which or how much of what is involved. I happen to believe that the proper way to call people is to sit down and discuss a job with them and to withdraw a call if it, on the basis of that discussion, seems not appropriate to go forward with it, unless you have, in fact, feel like you are compelled by inspirational revelation to go ahead and extend the call. And I think you can withdraw a call and people can move out of it gracefully. And I personally have never declined a call when it was made as a call. But I've talked a couple of people out of extending calls on a couple of occasions. I have convinced them it was in their and my best interest not to extend the call at that point in time.
I've explained situations to bishops and say, now do you want me to do it? After I've explained the conditions, and sometimes they've taken the call back, if you will. I agree with Brother Robeson that bishops are generally successful in their service, but I don't think that everything that they're successful in everything they do, every choice they make. I think we make mistakes.
One last question.
What's the question? I'm a little hard of hearing.
He was saying he should follow the bishop's manual carefully, because if
My general response to that, that's an excuse, not a problem. And the institution and the organization is not fragile. It has strength like I can't believe. During one of my calls as bishop, I left the ward for 5 months and asked the stake president to release me, and I can't see that the world was much different at the end of the 5 months than when I left. The church will carry itself. Any bishop who thinks that he has a stronger responsibility to be in a sacrament meeting than in a hospital with the sick or somewhere with a person in need doesn't understand his calling, in my view. Your first responsibility is to pastoral responsibilities to members. And if you've got a sick or a poor or a needy member, that always takes precedence over the organizational needs. I can't conceive. Lowell will tell me. I've gone a step too far, but I can't conceive of an organizational need or requirement that can't be addressed if you have to call the stake president and get him to do it, that wouldn't excuse a bishop to do what he has to do if he has a serious problem to deal with in terms of a member of his ward. Now, if you believe that's to abolish an auxiliary, then you've got a problem. You let me read the handbook, and I can interpret it. I was always able to interpret the handbook in ways that allowed me to do what I thought ought to be done. And there are the iron rodders and there are the Liahonas, and I think you need to have the handbook read by the Liahonas. That's what Lowell taught me 100 years ago.
Time is just about up. One last question, Gene.
I guess it's more of a comment. I'm a little troubled by your comment earlier about the bishop's strength on the bishop. My testimony there when here is that it's enormously free opportunity, and that it's really probably depends on the membership. What I found as a bishop is that I would scream enormously by my state president.
High note, which we all wish we would have said, let's conclude with thanking you very much for your attention.